Saudi Arabia has spent the last decade trying to reinvent itself, pouring hundreds of billions into futuristic cities, global sports and infrastructure mega projects. At the centre of it all is Mohammed bin Salman, MBS as he's known, the young, ambitious leader who promised to transform the kingdom through something called Vision 2030. But now, some of the biggest, boldest ideas are being scaled back. So, what's happened to the Saudi spending spree? It's News Talk Daily, I'm Ciara Doherty. And a decade ago, there were some big ideas. And I mean really big ideas coming from the Arabian Peninsula. There were plans for a 100-mile-long city in the desert, year-round ski resorts in a country known for its heat, and entire new industries built from scratch, all funded by vast oil wealth. From the off, it looked all about image and influence and rewriting what Saudi Arabia is. Sport, of course, became a huge part of that push, from golf tours to boxing fights to football, a way of putting the country at the centre of global culture almost instantly. But now, reality is starting to bite. Falling oil revenues, uncertain global politics, of course, and a lack of the forward investment they were banking on have forced a rethink. Some projects are being downsized, paused, some dropped entirely. And it really seems that the steam that was there 5 years ago isn't there to nearly the same degree as before. Well, later I'll be joined by Dr. Rahaf Al-Dulgi. She is a lecturer in Middle East and North African Studies at Lancaster University. But first, we are joined by News Talk's own Susan Hayes-Cullerton. You are very welcome back to News Talk Daily. It is always a pleasure.
Thank you, Ciara. It's always a delight to be here.
So let's start right with this Vision 2030, because the figures are absolutely eye-watering, as were the plans. It's staggering. Tell me about it.
So first off, to put this in context, Saudi Arabia as an economy is somewhere in between the Netherlands and Switzerland. So it's around about $1.1 trillion. And I'm going to put that into context in a moment. It is making 60% of its government revenue from oil. 65% of its exports comes from oil. And the whole idea of this, Ciara, back in 2017 was Saudi Arabia knew that it was relying upon oil. How does it diversify away from that? How, just like Dubai did, how does it generate other exports and other ways of making money? So one of them, of course, is by attracting more people to live there and work there in different areas. Now, the plans that they had was to come up with Vision 2030, which it was going to be all sorts of physical structures, which we'll get into, and they thought it was going to cost $500 million. Sorry, 500 billion, I should say.
I was thinking.
Sorry.
That was a
million.
Lot of infrastructure was, for half a billion, Susan.
God, if we could only do that here, right? So 500 billion, which is half a trillion. So again, just to put, like, that's a big number, Ciara, right? That's half their economy. However, by the time they got to 2024, they got an awful shock to realise this now would cost 8.8 trillion. And that is in the context of, imagine every single good and service that is produced in the economy and multiply that by 8 times. That was what it was going to cost the government. And so therefore they said, actually, do you know what? I think we need to roll back on this.
Okay, so to be clear, Susan, from the absolute outset, this vision was completely unsustainable.
Well, it was visionary. And at the time,
but we all have visions.
Oh yeah, well, but you see, the Middle East can do things because they've got different sorts of governments. I mean, to also look at, if you look at Palm Island in Dubai, or if you look at what Abu Dhabi has done in terms of its infrastructure, they have got an enormous amount of resources. So in terms of the visions that they come up with, like, since they can take stuff out of the ground and sell it at a high price. So at the time, it would have been seen as visionary. Now, also, physically, there was a lot of questions over these things. Like, they wanted to come up with a 170-kilometre, mile-long city, and this was going to be higher than the Empire State. It was going to house 1.5 million people. That's now been slashed to 300,000 people. So the unsustainability of this wouldn't have been as obvious from the beginning, but it's as time has gone on. The other thing too is where this came from is in an autocratic government, and therefore, if I could say it, therefore they tend to be surrounded by people who agree with them, but they're not the same people, of course, who have to fund it or build it.
And I suppose, as you say from the outset, right, the tension here was that this was to help their economy to diversify away from oil, and you've just outlined how important that was to them. But it had to be funded by oil, didn't it? To get to that point, and there's been so much volatility around oil prices over the last number of years. Was that also part of the problem?
Oh, this is the problem. I mean, the reality is if 60% of the money that you're getting in order to do anything in government comes from oil, it's going to be dependent on the price that you're able to get for it. So the break-even price of oil that Saudi Arabia needs was $96 a barrel. Now, and previous to that, it was $91 a barrel. So that is only increasing, obviously, with the rise in cost. But the price of oil, Ciara, hasn't been at that level for quite some time. It has in the last couple of months, of course, and we've seen it go over $110 a barrel in some cases. But the reality here is that Saudi Arabia needed the oil price to be higher to diversify away from it. And at the very time that it needed high oil prices with a view to building the infrastructure that could attract the tourism and the industry and so on, it didn't have it. So then what did it do? It went off and it borrowed. And so now it's the amount of borrowing that it has is now 30% of GDP. To the rest of us here in Europe, that seems a very small percentage. But when you're looking at the sheer amounts of the deficit, which is how much they're spending versus what they're taking in, that's causing a bigger and bigger and bigger problem.
But just to go back, I suppose, to what the vision was, right? What was their economy going to be built on once Vision 30 was up and running?
Okay, well, let me tell
you. If it had happened, if it had all materialised, where do they see the revenues being generated post-oil?
Okay, so there was going to be 1 million residential units that was going to be created on this. It was going to wean the country off being a petrodollar state. So therefore, if you take a look at Dubai and you look at the sheer amount of tourism that's there, the sheer amount of indigenous industry that's there, and also the amount of people that are working there then that would be in non-oil related industries, in contrast to somewhere like Abu Dhabi, that is a sense of where they wanted to go. It was supposed to be the world's biggest construction market. So they were also going to be attracting a lot of people to come into the environment for that. And in Riyadh alone, they wanted to add 29,000 hotel rooms, 4.6 million square metres of office space and 340,000 homes by the start of the decade. It's also important too that we talk about the social structure of Saudi Arabia. It's only 5 years ago women were allowed to drive and go to sporting events. So you can imagine when it comes to women in the workplace that there would have been a big question about that as well. So by bringing and liberalising the social structures that were there, they wanted to be opening up the world for business.
And I should advise News Talk Daily listeners, if they get a chance, just look up the line, right? Google a picture of it, because it was meant to completely redefine the concept of a city. It stretched straight across more than 100 miles, 161 kilometres, I think Dublin to Belfast, of this untapped land in the northwest of Saudi. And the line itself was taller than the Shard, taller than the Empire State Building. I think it was about 500 metres tall, 200 metres wide. I mean, it was so ambitious, as you say, to the point of actually perhaps not being realistic. But when you look at the projects, these mega projects, there's vanity there too, isn't there?
There is.
No, Susan's saying maybe not. You've been very kind here.
I am. I'm trying, like, because I think that one of the challenges that we have in Ireland is that we often say we haven't enough vision, and particularly we haven't enough vision for our infrastructure. So I'm trying to be objective here, and I'm trying to look through the lens of living in Ireland, where we have an infrastructure deficit, and also where we have got a sovereign wealth fund as well arising from corporation taxes. And I think sometimes we could do with more. But the problem here is some of the physics just didn't add up. Like, when you look at the cube-shaped skyscraper that was going to be built, this was going to be enough to fit 20 Empire State buildings in it. There was going to be a mirror that was going to be over the line as well. They were going to also as well, they were going to hold the Winter Olympics in the desert in 2029. That has since been cancelled. Like, the whole idea of making things that were bigger and better and shinier can often be a thing that happens in the Gulf States. But we can also see that in some cases that this has been done. So is there ego? I think there certainly is some of it there. Is there good long-term planning that could have gone well? There is. And somewhere in the middle, MBS got surrounded by people who said, yeah, we can do that. And this, I think, fundamentally comes down to it. How did somebody think this could cost $500 billion? And then just a couple of years later, it was going to be 8.8.
So this is their National Children's Hospital, but on a much bigger scale. But I actually know that isn't, because they haven't spent it.
They
got the memo, folks.
They spent $50 billion and got kind of a few reports. Like, I mean, that's it.
Do they not, though, have a reputation, Susan, of announcing these big, shiny, futuristic, hugely ambitious, visionary projects, and then a couple of years later going, yeah, no, I'm actually not going to follow through with that?
Well, you have to think about, well, what is that for? I mean, sometimes there's a case of build it and it will come. But also, if you look at the physical infrastructure being out in the Gulf States, I mean, you're dealing with an awful lot of desert. You're dealing with a lot of, if anybody looks at what Dubai as a region looked like, or as a city looked like 40 years ago, I mean, it was this small, I won't call it a backwater, but
it was
at this tiny little place. So the what I think is interesting about that part of the world is just they're new to this. I mean, remember the oil in Abu Dhabi was only discovered in the 1950s. This is something that is relatively new. And also they have such a strong economy within themselves as well. When we then look at what's gone on since the 28th of February and the closing of the Storm of Hormuz, then you have an issue of where, first of all, they can't actually get the oil out of the country. And then they've then moved it of where they're actually positioned, so that then rather than going through the Strait, they're going across the Red Sea and into the East-West Tunnel. Then you've got an awful lot of changing infrastructure needs there that can't always be done. And of course, Ciara, there's no doubt about it. We have to mention the fact that the Saudi Arabian government said, we are building this, and then just moved people out of there. There's been a lot of sustainability and human rights issues that have come up here as well. So this isn't just an economic or a social or even a political structure. There's also a really strong social element here, of which they've come under a lot of global scrutiny.
There was also an assumption, wasn't there, I suppose, from MBS and the other people in authority there, that if you build it, they will come. I mean, that's also a high-risk strategy. How sure were they that there would be this demand for these facilities if they put that infrastructure into place?
Well, this is why they wanted to do things like, and they're still preparing for the World Expo in 2030, FIFA World Cup in 2034. Like I was saying, the Winter Olympics, which has since been moved on, that was going to be there in 2029. If you give people a reason to come. Now, also, Saudi Arabia wouldn't have been top of people's list of places to go and visit because of the social structures that I had mentioned earlier, particularly for women travelling on their own, in terms of doing business there. There's far more friendlier places, I suppose, that could be appropriate for that.
And also people just really uncomfortable with how socially conservative it is as a country.
Precisely. So as a result then, when you look at the tourism numbers that they have in the country, an awful lot of the tourism is local. And so in order to build it and they will come, you have to give people a reason to be there. And so when you think about all of the industrial space and all of the economic incentives that were going to be there from the perspective of foreign direct investment, that was the whole rationale.
Okay, final question. It's not gone, this project, but it is significantly scaled back. What does that look like now? And do you see that scaling back as a big failure?
If you think about, is failure making a decision to not pursue something that was infeasible in the first place, but then it's just reality coming home to roost. I think what we really need to look at here is, first of all, there was about 20 big construction projects planned. That's been scaled back to 3. The real question is, could it be scaled back to none? And the one thing to watch here is that the budget shortfall widened to $33.5 billion in the first 3 months of the year. And that is in an environment where we saw oil prices going up over $110 a barrel. So I think the sustainability comes down to how open the debt markets are to Saudi Arabia and then where this goes from here. But also, they spend a lot of money on PR campaigns. Unfortunately, this isn't working out. I wouldn't rule out that something may come of this again, but I think Project 2030, as it was seen originally, will go down in the history books as what it could have been.
All right. Susan, thank you for all of your insights, and always lovely to have you here on News Talk Daily.
Thanks so much, Ciara.
We're now joined by Dr. Rahaf Al-Dulgi. She is lecturer in Middle East and North African Studies at Lancaster University. You're very welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's start with Mohammed bin Salman, right? He's 40 years of age. He's an extremely wealthy person in his own right. Somewhere between $5 billion and $25 billion is his own personal worth. What else do we know about him? Who is he? What shaped him? What kind of a leader is he? What was his, I suppose, vision for Saudi?
Well, when he rose, first of all, he is one of the younger leaders in the Middle East. But he was born in the 1985, and he's the eldest son of King Salman from his third wife. He's not hailing from a military background. Like, his childhood were mostly spent in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, and he was not educated in the West. When his father became a king in 2015, he was only 29 years old, with no military background. And also, he was made defense minister and immediately launches the war in Yemen. I think his trajectory by 2017, he outmaneuvered his cousin to become crown prince. And he has locked up rival royals and businessmen in the Ritz-Carlton. And that was a scandalous in the so-called anti-corruption purge. And he is basically now, like for a decade, he is running the country. And he's also a prime minister. So what that mean, he is, we have one man around 40 controlling the military, the economy, the royal court, and a sovereign wealth fund north of $1 trillion without real check.
So he's really managed to consolidate power within Saudi.
Yes, for the last decade. And he used many strategies for that. And I think for the last decade, we saw also not only in terms of who is leading Saudi Arabia, we saw transformations in terms of the society, culture, a bit of economy. And we saw not only a rise to power, a young crown prince, but also that the change and the shift in social cultural dynamics within Saudi Arabia. So his rise to power marks a new era in Saudi Arabia as well.
And this brings us to his vision 2030, which was much more than just sort of basic economic reform of the country, trying to ensure the future of the country in a world perhaps when there's not the same reliance on oil. He saw it really as a full rebranding of Saudi Arabia globally.
Exactly. So Vision 2030 was launched in 2016, and it was kind of perceived as something as the umbrella for everything. So the headline goal was Saudi Arabia's oil is weaning. And before the oil in Saudi Arabia weans, we need to diversify our economy. We saw that the narrative used that it's the 2030 vision aims to grow private sector, get more women into the workforce, build a tourism industry from basically zero, and develop entertainment, culture, raise non-oil revenue, and create these world-class giga projects to showcase the new Saudi Arabia. And also, I see that as that also having a social side. We saw cinemas reopened, women allowed to drive, mixed gender concerts, and that liberalization. So the narrative used for 2030 was more of a modernizing Saudi Arabia, that Saudi Arabia is stepping out of conservatism. And that was another challenge for the crown prince. So it's not, he was not only trying to materialize a very kind of very big idea about the line, the new building, the new city, but it was also a challenge to change society from inside, because it was not only about the oil or diversifying revenues in Saudi Arabia, but it was also about that shift in the social cultural dynamics internally. And also, it was not easy for a young leader to challenge conservatives' mainstream ideas within Saudi Arabia, especially from the base ulama that has been leading Saudi Arabia for decades since its like formation. So he had that project in his mind, making it successful not only for Saudi Arabia economy, but also to mark his rise as the best, well-remembered crown prince, I think. And we see it mostly leaders in the region, especially when we are talking about authoritarian context in mostly these countries. We see that leaders want to be remembered with very, very big ideas or building mansions, building cities. Yeah, and that's that. It's kind of using soft power.
Talk to me about the spending on sport too. What was the strategy there? What was the thinking?
Sport is very much similar to, it's more of a soft power tool. You need, you know, in countries, I feel like Saudi Arabia is very much interested and the population there, even the Saudi Arabia community is very much use sport as a way of an entertainment and also They are very big about winning the World Cup or the regional Middle Eastern Cup. So the spending started on sport early on, and I think I can't ignore the geopolitical competition between Qatar, UAE, and Saudi Arabia in terms of their spending on sport. It became for them as a marker for rise as middle power within the Middle East. And also there is a competition and also as a rebranding for the West. So I think like it's the sport thing is more to give the legitimacy, the soft power legitimacy. And it's more about propaganda, and that it can be said that this the cut in spending on sport is related, or I can claim that the discourse that's coming from Saudi Arabia will say that because of the current or the recent war on Iran and the struggle in the region is the one that's pushing them to cut spending on sport. However, it's part of or used tool to legitimize and to for rebranding.
So why now? Why are these ideas being scaled back? Not completely abandoned, I would say, but certainly being reduced.
While from the beginning, there has been lots of skepticism about the realization of this of these projects. But now, even though now MPS would easily use it and say that because of the conflict between the US and what's happening with Hormuz, all of these, the current situation is pushing us to cut spending. However, I think from the very beginning, the idea or the project was not well studied, and it was used more of a propaganda for MPS rise of power. And to also, he needed that so he can contain any this communal dissatisfaction internally inside Saudi Arabia.
All right, we're going to leave that there. Dr. Rahaf Al-Dughli, thank you for speaking to us here on News Talk Daily.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, that's it from News Talk Daily today. Thanks, as always, for listening. Love to have your company. Until Monday morning, take care. Goodbye.